Maybe I can present something here. And thank you for inviting. And so today you might read the flyer, which was very nice, nicely made by Aunt. And so today I want to... Is it fine?
I still haven't got it.
Soon, yes. And today what I want to share with you is that my own experience as a PhD student who is from Japan, who did her PhD in this British university. And as you might already saw in that flyer, my title of my PhD was Geopolitics as a Traveling Theory, the Evolution of Geopolitical Imagination in Japan, which is 1925 to 1945. And it was very much straightforwardly about politics and geography. So my kind of struggle has been how I can bring Japanese literature within into my PhD, rather, especially theoretically, not empirically, has been my question. And
still not here.
Not here? Wait, I think it has gone to your place, maybe. It takes time.
Well, it should be here because we exchanged emails earlier, so.
Okay, so anyway, I'll do without using PowerPoint. So first, when I came here, that was 4 years ago, my research question was kind of hopelessly broad. That was, how did Japan become part of the West? And that was my first research question. And I had this question when I was doing my master's degree. That was in the United States, and that was at Virginia Tech. And that means my supervisor at that time was Gerald Toll, some of whom might know. He's one of the so-called founder of critical geopolitics. And so that question was actually within critical geopolitical literature, which argues that great powers are doing boundary making practice. And simplifying the world map into the West and the East was arguments they made. And I had this question while I was learning about critical geopolitics. And this question was at least for me significant, because when you think about Japan's Westernness, it is somewhat tricky. That means maybe most of you might agree that Japan is actually part of the West. But if you think about Turkey or Russia, it might be a little bit difficult to say that Turkey is absolutely within the Western community. Maybe not. Then Russia, it is really difficult to say they are kind of part of the West. On the other hand, probably many of you agree that Japan can be part of the West, at least politically. But when we think about my race, it's not... obviously not Western, then why Japan, and also geography is crucial, because it is located in the Far East, but still it can be West. So why was my question? And actually, critical geopolitics largely relies on the method of Foucault. That means it is the same for the critical theory in IR in general. So. Yes, that is, yes, thank you. So that was a question. And Foucault actually said in his writings that his theory, his argument is basically within the West. Then my feeling was, then I can't use Foucault to analyze my own country, because it is not geographically part of the West. Then another question for me was, when you say, for example, post-structuralism, that posits that you have structuralism in advance, then what I don't get is if Japan share the experience, the structure, and maybe if you say post-modern, that means we have the same modernity with the West. But I don't really get whose modernity it is. So then it becomes something like whose West it is, because we don't have, as Patrick Jackson argued, we don't have no West Pole or East Pole. We just have South Pole and a North Pole. Though it is, I don't know why it is. So that was my question. And so actually it took really long time to reach or restate my research question. That took almost like 1.5 years. So that was around this time of the second year of my PhD. I reached two new research questions. And the first one is a theoretical one. That was, how does geopolitical thought travel long distance and contribute to process of political specialization in a recipient community? And the second one is empirical, that how do Japanese people form their geopolitical imaginations by importing theories of classical European geopolitics in the first half of the 20th century? So that means, to simplify, it is, did Japan imported the theory, literally? And so in one sense, I just restate the question in terms of my own question. So I made my question itself into somewhat like a research question. And that was because around this time, when I think about my research, when I don't really think about speciality, I just felt like I maybe lose my own identity as a Japanese, even if I can do the research on that. If I lose my identity as a Japanese, I just thought it is somewhat meaningless. So that was my struggle. In any sense, I had to find what space means for me. And I thought that was a question of subject and power. Yes, and so in a nutshell, my PhD was an account of a conceptual history, and my concentration was theory of the state as a living organism, that which was proposed first by Friedrich Ratzel at the end of 19th century. And that is, for me, about how people imagine the state by learning some kind of history. Yes, and for this talk, I just go to the conclusion of the thesis first, because it's not really about the thesis, but about my experience. So my conclusion is that geopolitical knowledge becomes power in a foreign community only when it fits into the vernacular, which defines the relation of geography and politics developed in the community according to its collective experience. So that means in Japan, the state imagined as something with no border. And so it is very much different from Western notion of the state, which is within a bounded space. And if you think about Russell's theory, which posits that a state is like just organism that has Lebensraum, that means bounded area. So that means a kind of the heart of classical geopolitics is ecological, no, geographical determinism. But in Japanese geopolitics, which was imported from Germany, it turns into ecological fatalism. This is my naming, though. So that was the conclusion. And so the kind of what I want to talk today is how I reached this next one. Conclusion. So the first thing a PhD do is of course so-called literature review, and so now I have research question and what the literature review can be. What I found was actually this literature review has really kind of enormous gap for me, and which means for example IR. International relations is said to have a historiographical turn recently, and which is a good example is maybe the rise of classical realism. That means they argue that actually Morgenthau's theory is not that, but this. And so that is that for this argument, they largely relies on the Cambridge School's contextualism by Skinner and so forth, so on and so forth. But it is still just, they are talking about context, but it is just a temporal context. So it is not enough. And then I go to a so-called literature of geography of knowledge. It is still very small, but still exists. And they argue that space is actually essential for knowledge production. So that is their argument. And for example, Livingstone examines how Darwinism are translated differently in a different intellectual community. But actually still, this is within a Western community in any sense, theoretically and geographically. Temporarily, it is different, but still it is not really, at least for me, in a geography of knowledge in a wider sense. And another one is a so-called global IR, international relations literature. It is somewhat newly developing one. And then, for example, Amitav Acharya, who is head of ISA, argues that we need to localize the concept. Yes, it is. But my question was localization of concepts is already something what we have been doing. We are just not talking about that. It is already localized, actually, at least in practice, if not theoretically. So that is, in that sense, not enough for me. Then, in all in all those literatures, it seems to me posits that intellectual history is actually just unilinear. You can think about humans' intellectual development as just one thing. We just move to structuralism, to post-structuralism, whatever it is. That is, for me, seems like a basic idea. And again, whose modernity it is and whose structure. We can have structures, actually, in a global, on the globe. So that was my feeling. Then we need not just time, but also space. I'm not saying that we just in favor of space, but actually we need time and space both. We need to think about that if we think about our global conceptual history seriously. So here, what I want to argue is actually if you think about only time, the analytical space is just about West, not yet. So it is, I would argue that the analytical space itself is always Western construction. And for example, Edward Said says in his Orientalism, it is not direct quote, I paraphrase a little bit, the imaginative geography of the self does not require consensus between the self and the other. So that means the text written by Orientalists was read only by Orientalists and not Orientals. And it seems to me that was a crucial point. Next, yes. And then, so that was the reason I tried to include Japanese literature within my PhD as a theoretical resource, not empirical resource. And fortunately for me, Japan has a relatively thick literature of intellectual history. And specifically relied on this person whose name is Maruyama Masao. He's probably the most famous Japanese political scientist or intellectual historian. He might prefer that name. So he was born in 1914, and he became a scholar almost during the war. And he became very famous even within the popular imagination after the war. And so his question was, he was kind of icon of democracy, post-war democracy. And his question was the question of Japanization of any thought or theory that is imported. So that means Japan just imported lots of Western thought, not just during modern era, it is said that actually Japan imported 14,000 books in a century. And also, when we go back to the history, Japan imported a Chinese political theory in the 7th century and onward. So that was always political theory was always borrowing for Japan from somewhere. So his question was, it seems like, for example, Japan, as I already said, Japan was considered to be a good student of Westernization, and Japan is the first non-Western modern state. Probably it is right, but for Maruyama, it looks like the Japanese state is a little bit different, and the Japanese democracy is a little bit different. But actually, it's not something just he thought, because we have a so-called Japan model of economic growth. We have Japan model of democracy. It's less referred though. But we have something like a particularly Japanese model, maybe Chinese model is the same thing. On the other hand, some argues that Japan is a good follower of the West. And especially within geopolitics and critical geopolitics literature, Japan is considered to be the follower of imperialism. So that was a kind of a contradiction I identified. And then also Maruyama identified far before I thought that was funny. And in order to address his own question of Japanization, so he relied on Karl Mannheim's sociology of knowledge. Actually, he's known as a scholar of Japanese political thought, but he read a lot of German political, German humanity, and for that was a very much important part of his analysis. And but when he developed the concept of Basso Senato, which is today I want to talk about, yet, he was actually severely criticized in two different ways. That is, first one is he's criticized as a Western modernist, but some criticized him as a Japanese revisionist, which considered Japanness is very much important. So it is somewhat contradictory why he has these two criticisms. One is Western modernist and one is Japanese revisionist. It is a very opposite thing. So why is a kind of question I try to figure out throughout my research. So Basso Ostinato, what's the Basso concept of Basso Ostinato? I already published a paper on this topic with him, and then he's Felix Loth. So if you are interested in, please read it. Anyway, so this is a Basso Ostinato is a borrowing from music, and that means a recurrent pattern of bass notes in a melody. But this bass note does not significantly change the melody, but still it affects to the melody. It's basic idea he wanted to express by borrowing the term from music. So this is basically about, I would say, how you think and not what you think. That means the same melody can be played in any place in the same way, but maybe the way of playing or the way of adding some bass notes might be different. It's a basic idea of Basso Ostinato. And but this was unfortunately, because he was criticized severely, within the Japanese literature, it was an inconclusive, unfinished concept. So in my PhD, I reconceptualized it as a manifestation of everyday relations in a particular society in which subject and the law which they are subject to are articulated. So here, my interest is a neglected difference between different analytical spaces. That means when theory travels, theory was born in a particular place, but when it travels, it is understood from a by different analytical space. It's my argument. And what my interest was, what happens in between those spaces. So that is somewhat the difference that has been neglected. And also, probably, it is some kind of unconscious mutation, even for the receiver of the theory. And I call the difference as an unsynthesizable cognitive void between analytical spaces. And it is actually a very helpful concept for me. But on the other hand, it has a clear difficulty. One is, as I wrote here, the danger of stereotyping, generalization. It can be deterministic because Japanese tend to think this way, can become easily. Japan thinks this way. Then you are Japanese, then you think that way. It becomes somewhat kind of stereotyping. Then we can easily conclude to the determinism, or maybe world are just different, so we can't find any meeting points between each other. That is one difficulty. And the second difficulty for me is a somewhat bas ostinato can be used for so-called teleological view. That means maybe philosophical argument. That means we need to attain this. In order to do that, we have to believe the difference, or we have to argue for this, or something like that. That was something I did not want to do. So for those reasons, I reconceptualized the bas ostinato as a heuristics device. That is, that means I did not posit it somewhat primordial or somewhat static. But this particular concept of bas ostinato is in order to find the neglected difference I want to identify. I'm not arguing this is the Japanese way of thinking. Probably we can say at some point of history Japanese had this kind of way of thinking, and that could affect the importation of knowledge was the argument. And in order to think about what the difference means, we maybe use this heuristic device. So that was a basic idea. I used this concept. Yes. So by using this concept, I analyzed Japanese geopolitics. And what's the difference between Japanese geopolitics and Western classical geopolitics? I already mentioned some of them. And in Japan, it is called Daito Chiseigaku, which means Great East Asia geopolitics. Some of you might know, but the Japanese, during the war period, had a very ambitious world order, a design for world order. It is called Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. They argued that Japan would change the world order, which is the order for regions. So they envisaged a world order composed by regions, but not states. And they argued that for this world order, state has to be expanded. So state, the end of the state we have to see, was the argument Japan made using those, not just geopolitics, but several political theories. So, and in that sense, Japanese geopolitics was actually inclusive theory. I'm not saying inclusivity is just good. Not that. It was brutal, and the history said it was wrong. But purely, we consider about what the difference between Japanese geopolitics and Western geopolitics. It was actually, theoretically at least, inclusive theory. And because in this theory, state was imagined as borderless, not within a border. So that means it was not about Lebensraum, which is a very well-known term within geopolitics, But actually, that was about Levin's form. It is almost not known. But actually, this term was first proposed by Rudolf Kellen, who is a Swedish geographer. And that became very prominent within Japanese geopolitics. But interestingly, within Japanese geopolitics and Western geopolitics, this Levin's form thing was totally forgotten these days. So in a nutshell, Japanese geopolitics was, as I said, that was about ecological fatalism. It's a variant of geographical determinism, which argues that actually it's not geography that determines, but it is actually changing geography that determines who is the winner. So we can say that it is ontology of becoming, which is now prominent within the critical theory of space and place. So it is Japanese geopolitics was, at least for the Japanese, very much unbelievably idealist theory, because they just believed that it is inclusive and it is maybe welcomed by Chinese or Koreans. And that was, in that sense, unbelievably, hopelessly idealist, and not at all realist theory as it is said by Western geopolitics. So my argument was that conversion was because of Japanese epistemology, in contrast of Cartesian epistemology, as a critical geopolitics argues. All in all, when I consider this, those characteristics of Japanese geopolitics, I think it is very much closer to today's critical theory and critical geopolitics. I'm not saying it is almost the same. It is crucially somewhat very similar. And so that was my argument I made in it is a little bit deep, so I'll leave it today because it's confusing. But anyway, I'm kind of reaching somewhat to the kind of conclusion. So here what I wanted to think was, as I said, it was about plurality of analytical space. And the question for me was something about, as I said, it was a question of subjectivity and power. For subjectivity, that means I wanted to think about whose theory it is. So, for example, you said it is critical theory, but to whom it is critical? We say that it is a realist theory, but to whom it is real? So it seems, then it depends on not just temporal context, but also spatial context. So first of all, when we talk about theory, whatever it is, and when we put adjective on it, it seems to me it is necessary to think about whose theory it is, because we can have different analytical spaces. One can be Japanese, one can be Western. I don't really say it is primordial, but still we can have some kind of a community, though it can be changed incessantly. So that is one thing I wanted to argue in the thesis. And the other one is, when we think about power, critical theory tends to argue that power is just from power over, and it is oppressive. And but is that so, was something I wanted to say. That is because we can consider that power is actually site-specific. How power works depends on the community. International relations tends to think about power over, that is, of domination. But for Japanese geopolitics, and so this power over works very well when you think about environmental determinism. But for Japanese ecological fatalism, it is much more like power to, or power among. We have power here, and whose power is decided by geography and not by someone who is powerful. So that is another thing I wanted to consider. And the last point is somewhat still kind of half-baked in me, but we need to think about then, if we think about whose theory and whose power, then and when we analyze something, audience become actually very much crucial thing, because in the end, I did something somewhat very interdisciplinary, interregional research, although my field was critical geopolitics. Then when I think about, for example, a publication, to what kind of audience I can talk to is maybe for many people, it is kind of hopelessly broad, because what I said earlier, what I wanted to do through this thesis was I wanted to write something that can be read both by Western scholar and a Japanese scholar and maybe some others. That was what I wanted to do. And I found out actually this is maybe very difficult to say who what kind of audience I can have. Yeah, so then at the last, I did not really think about this slide. But anyway, so that means, you know, we must think, when we think about, particularly when think about space, we need to think about, is this the investigation of the self or of the other? So as I said, how we frame the audience, and whose I are, whose international relations, is it Western international relations we are talking about, or Japanese international relations, or Chinese international relations? And finally, as I said, the question I want to propose today is, can our analysis be mutually readable or not? Thank you so much.
So thank you, Tsuko, for a fantastic presentation, and I think the point of audience is a good one to finish on. So we'll now take questions from the audience. So please start shooting anything. Okay. So I'll perhaps start if no one's taking the privilege. So you finish on this question of, can our analysis be mutually readable? Do you have an answer, half-baked or
actually, yes,
baked?
It is completely half-baked. And actually, that was something I did not really include my thesis. But that came into my mind almost yesterday and today when I think about this presentation, and also now I finish my thesis, I have to think about publication, how to publish my book. And then my internal examiner, who was Stuart Erden, said, the text is really good, but the problem might be who is the audience when make it as a book. And that was really something I thought I have to think, and I still don't know. Maybe as a text, my text can be read by Japanese scholars and also Western scholars, but already Western scholars read at least. And probably Japanese scholars, of course, there is a problem of language, but still, if he or she can read Japanese, maybe it is still readable. But I still don't know how I can address this question.
Thank you. Fantastic presentation. I was really fascinated by the argument you made of the specificity of the Japanese reading of the German geopolitical text, and the influence that it had, that the Japanese thought of the state as a borderless entity, because it wasn't, I mean, presumably, I understand that it must be because it wasn't a frontier state, it was an island, so it didn't have this this sort of dilemma as the Germans may have had. So I was wondering if you could expand a little bit more on what that meant for the Japanese, and also this, what you call, was it environmental fatalism?
Yeah, yes, it was ecological fatalism.
Yeah, and like, what, if you could like talk a bit more about what that meant in opposition to the ecological determinism of the Germans, like, what was distinct about that? Because I was a bit unclear what that meant in the Japanese context.
That means the difference between environmental determinism and ecological fatalism. So environmental determinism is largely understood as something that geography is static, and it just affects on who you are. So it is basically social Darwinistic theory, and but it is more. Precisely, it is neo-Lamarckian, which means the strong is the winner. It does not consider the evolution, actually. So it is, in a strict sense, not Darwinism, but it is kind of a Darwinistic argument. And Japanese ecological fatalism is more like, no, actually geography is changing, and the situation is always changing. Then we can find some winner in this changing situation or condition. So it is something always changing. So as a result of change, we can have a winner. So it is not determinism in the same sense, but it is a little bit different. And in terms of why Japan had this different determinism. It's one reason is, of course, because Japan was not the West. And so if geographical determinism argues for that West is superior because Europe is in a good position on the Earth, it doesn't work for Japan. Japan is Far East. Then we Japanese had to think about something that explains their raising up their situation as a raising power in a little bit different term. So that was another reason they developed this ecological determinism. But I don't say that because for the practical reason they did. But actually their linguistic tradition and also, as I said, way of thinking somewhat interpreted this determinism in a little bit different way. Is that what I wanted to say? Yes, and I missed the first question probably.
Well, I was also wondering about the borderless state, what that meant to the Japanese a bit more, as opposed to the European living style, I guess.
Right.
Like, what was that?
The difference.
Yeah.
So actually, Japan had the notion of state because it is just imported. But Japan had old notion of state, of course, because not only Japan, but in East Asia, in general, they have state. And for Japan, the notion of state, which is the interpretation of the state in English, that is in Japanese, actually, kokka, or kuni. The term itself originated from 7th century when they imported. And in China, it is originated from probably 400 BC or before. Then it is really old notion. And already it has that kind of image of the state. And then it became a Japanese notion to some extent. Then it became a kind of mixture of Western notion of states and also Japanese. Then not in Japan, but East Asia in general, maybe it is safe to say that border is not so salient. Maybe, for example, Chinese does not really have the notion of the state as a inclusive, kind of exclusive, bounded land. They tend to conceptualize state as a more concentric structure, which has no clear border. is the argument I read, and I agree. Yes.
I think actually that the distinction between Japanese understanding of word and German understanding of word is not necessarily that diverse. Maybe look at the work of Georg Simmel, for example, who says that word is not a spatial fact that forms itself sociologically, but it's like a social fact that forms itself spatially. And I think that has something to do also with German history, in the sense that it understood itself as a late state, nation state, in comparison to, let's say, UK and France. And it's actually a big discussion. There was a discussion about a small German solution and a big German solution. A big German solution would have included Austria, but obviously Prussia didn't want to have that, because that would have been like, you know, a power split, so it wanted to exclude Austria. So I think that there's actually, in a traditional sense of understanding, kind of like somewhat of like a relational understanding of board as well. And I think there's some similarities here with Japan, which I find interesting, because when you take Japan, actually, you know, this is one of the, let's say, few countries where you actually could imagine that they have a very spatial understanding of border, because it's an island, right? So there's an actual, let's say, there's an actual fact.
Mm-hmm.
Where the water starts, that's where the border is, right? So yeah, I just wanted to add that.
Right. Yeah, it is some kind of interesting point, because I don't argue, and he doesn't argue, because Japan and Germany has a very similar, some different element can make something similar, is the argument I wanted to make, because Japan was just a naturally bordered land. And so in that sense, Japan has a notion of border. And simultaneously, not is and then it makes another kind of different similarities between different situations. Yes.
Hi. Thanks for your presentation. I was just wondering with the discussion about how the Japanese perceive the borders and how it's a little more fluid, how it has colored current. Tensions involving borders, especially the conflict is with China, again another
right.
country, which, and also it might not, I guess China, Japan, they would have different notions of borders and states, as opposed to other East Asian, maybe even Southeast Asian countries, because our perception of the state, the border, is also pretty much influenced by our colonial experiences.
Right,
so
right.
I was wondering how you can describe how it has shifted and how
right.
it permeates in the rest of the region.
Right, so that means in consideration of recent development also. That is actually the discussion I had during my Viva. And so Japanese notion is, in one sense, clearly overwhelmingly influenced by Chinese notion, and historically, under that Chinese order, Japan and Korea and Vietnam, to some extent, were clearly under that order. But distance made them understood the order a little bit differently, which means Korea is just next to China. Then they had much more rigid hierarchical order in their understanding. But for Japan, they had sea there, so that means they understood the Chinese concentric order a little bit differently from Korean people and also Chinese people. And so that was East Asia, and maybe Vietnam is of course close to China, so that might be close to the understanding of Korea. I don't really know about Vietnam, but I can maybe just infer that might be the case. And so that actually worked really well in one sense, because at least East Asia did not have war until modern periods because they didn't really have a clear border. But colonialism, I don't want to say that was good and that was intruded by Western notion. No, I'm not arguing that. But that was, as a fact, that was maybe true. Then colonial era began, and some of those countries influenced, of course, by a colonial notion. And in that sense, some of the argument of critical geopolitics is still very much plausible, and also, of course, critical scholarship explain a lot about this colonial development, but not mine. Towards the today, we have between China and Japan has that dispute, and this is clearly, of course, about territory, especially with that tiny islands. And so that, as I said, Basso-Ostinato is basically, I said, it is changing. It is, and that is the reason I used it as a heuristic device. That means it seems to me the notion of territory as an unbounded land is almost lost, even in the region. And as a result of incessant exchange of knowledge, I don't know if the difference I identified as unsynthesizable still exists or not, but it seems to me that we can say that the notion of territory, understanding of territory, is quite close to Western understanding, even within East Asia these days.
So I don't know if I'm so. So what about Okinawa, for example? Mm-hmm. Because we are talking about borderless, but Okinawa was conquest. So mm-hmm. I was wondering what's the role of imperialism in this idea of borderless state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you were talking also about power, right? And you were talking about power from.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds that maybe there is a power position there that justifies this needless of borders, because actually it's an imperial expansive position rather than, one that needs to shut down themselves.
Right. And then Okinawa's question was another one I had at the Viva, because what Japan did to Okinawa is undeniably exclusive. And then after the war, some of you might know, some of you might not. Japan kind of cut out Okinawa from the mainland, and then they just allowed Americans to occupy the island, and then it became part of the United States. So for that, my kind of answer is that Japan sometimes uses very conveniently the inclusive idea and exclusive idea. And actually it is not only Japan, but for most of us, for most of ideas, we have that kind of duality. We can justify both by using the same concept sometimes. By using Lebensraum, it can be inclusive, it can be exclusive. So in that sense, Okinawa's existence and history is somewhat subtly interesting. And for that reason, probably Okinawa has been still kind of issue of politics within Japan.
We should perhaps have a last round of questions.
My questions are, well, not really questions. I wanted to make some broad comments as a sort of very self-indulgent way of how I reacted also to what you're saying. Because, well, I think first that it's very generous that you shared with us your own subjective experience with the PhD. I think we don't get to hear about that more often. And I would urge you really, if you have the time or the luxury to do so, to write a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not the Viva version of the presentation, but actually the version that you gave us, because I think, personally, I'm struggling with some of the same questions about subjectivity and being someone who's not from here, but who's doing a PhD here.
Uh-huh.
And this raises all sorts of questions. I think you might agree, since we come from the same place, but the same question of how you how you construct this hierarchy of knowledge of where yourself become an empirical subject and you're taking the theoretical lens of where you are conducting the study. And then it raises all sorts of questions of when you go back, so when you go back to Japan, do you present authentic sort of non-Western Japanese back new in Western packages or not? I mean, this is not a very well formulated question, but this is just all the questions that I'm getting into my mind is how you publish, how you package your research, and how you come to a question that is authentic to yourself, to your identity, as you mentioned at the beginning. So yeah, so I thought that this was generous. I would really like to read something about that.
No, that means kind of when I go back to Japan and when I write, the kind of audience maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
And then my subjectivity or my own identity. I still don't know, because you know, as a PhD student, the way I managed kind of contradiction within me as a researcher and as a person. Was the way I managed was this, and it worked maybe as a project, and that was because at least it is now I kind of popped in my mind that idea, but probably in some sense I was able to do this criticism. Because I was doing my research within a Western context, it is maybe very much tricky. I was able to argue I'm doing this research from the Japanese perspective or from the Japanese analytical space because I was in this different context. And that means probably when I go back to Japan and when I found myself I have to write within Japanese literature, I don't know if it works or not, maybe not. I sometimes think that social science and the specificity of Japanese social science was Japan has been conducted social science by their own language. Until since 19th century. That means social science itself is actually indigenized and localized. So they have their own probably they have their own understanding of Go. They have their own understanding of Shumich, whomever it is. And then maybe what I will find might be I need to again resituate myself in what way? I don't know.
Right. Anyone has any burning questions? If not, then I'd ask you to join me one last time to thank Atsuko for a fantastic presentation and wish her all the best of luck with the next stage in her life.